I spoke with Scott Spencer and asked him why he created a character who made a living writing hack books under a pen name.
I think the impetus was really a fact I had come across in a book several years ago, and a book that I allude to inside the novel, a book called Warrant for Genocide by Professor Norman Cohn, in which he discusses the origins of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And I don't even remember why I was reading that book. Actually, I do. I was house-sitting many, many years ago for the late Bernard Malamud, and I found it in his shelf. And I started reading it, and I became totally engrossed by the fact that the Protocols, which were these pages and pages of genocidal lies, really came from the work of a pseudonymous author who was just a hack, writing page after page and basically being paid by the word. And he wrote whatever popped into his very mediocre mind. And then one day, a part of it, this banal fantasy of a bunch of rabbis meeting in a cemetery and discussing the fate of the European financial and political systems, was excerpted, was taken out of the context of one of his penny dreadful novels and took on a horrible life of its own. And the idea of the power of the word and the power of the written word and the incredible danger of writing down a lie seized my imagination and stayed there for many, many years until I finally got a chance to write The Men in Black.
Well, the character in your book ghostwrites a book about UFOs. He's also ghostwritten An Intelligent Woman's Guide to Pro Football, Traveling with Your Pet, and Crystal Death, which is a book about the hazards of table salt. Now, I know you've ghostwritten books, too, although I don't know what. Can you say?
You know I've ghostwritten books?
Yes.
Well, it's true, but I'm surprised that you do know. I did ghostwrite a couple of books, one about a television program and one about animals, and it was done a long time ago before I was lucky enough to begin earning a living as a real writer, and I suppose that experience stayed with me for a long time, and maybe this is my apology for that.
What was the TV show you wrote about?
The TV show I wrote about is not to be mentioned here, because then you would be able to find the book and realize that I had written it.
And you would what, die of shame? Or what would the consequence be if I found the book and read it?
It would be harder for me to forget that I did it. It's you know, when the more people who know about it, the more difficult it becomes for me to deny that I ever did it.
Well, you must have drawn on that experience for this novel.
Well, I drew on the experience of what a dreadful and nasty business it is to just churn out page after page. What didn't happen with this book was I mean, it certainly didn't take off and make all kinds of money. It just came out and went. But there was a tremendous shock once when I was reading the New York Review of Books, which is just, you know, a great august journal, and I saw a reference to one of the books that I had written in this writer's argument about some larger cultural topic, and I felt really, really ashamed, because in fact this television program that I had written about was very, very prominent at the time, but I was living in absolute poverty in the middle of nowhere and didn't even have a television set. So, in fact, I'd never even seen this show, and the fly-by-night publisher sent me synopses of what was on the show on a week-by-week basis, and I kind of read through these and then spun out this 160 pages of garbage about it.
Scott Spencer is my guest, and he has a new novel called Men in Black. Your character in the novel goes on the road to do a book tour, but of course, since he didn't write this book under his own name, he has to go in character as the pseudonym. And he goes to a bookstore, and all the people who show up for his signing are the kind of people who'd like a book about UFOs, but there aren't the kind of people who'd like the literary books he writes or that would even like him. In fact, can I have you read a paragraph?
Sure.
About that?
Okay. Inside the store, there was a large crowd, mostly of the sort of people I was coming to expect. Not for me, the girls in their summer dresses, the sultry women in their black leotards, the grad students with pulsating eyes, the latter-day bohos and berets. No, my readers had casts on their feet, ace bandages on their ankles, patches on their eyes. They received radio signals through the fillings in their teeth. They needed to lose weight, gargle. They had lost their meager inheritance in pyramid schemes. They wouldn't mind selling you mail-order shoes or Amway kitchen cleansers. They rattled around the country on secondary roads where the gas and food were cheaper. They tested their cellars for radon. They called the Culligan man. They watched the Christian broadcasting system. They looked for stores that still sold 8-track tapes. They lived near electric power line towers the size of the Washington Monument. They had guns. I sat at a table and signed their books, listened to their stories. Sign it to Buster and say, "See you on the other side," one demanded. And, "Do you worry about assassination?" asked another, his mustache twitching, his teeth flashing.
Have you had this kind of alienating experience of going to a signing and finding readers who had nothing in common with you?
No, I haven't, because I've never written a book that, you know, I've never gone on the road with a book that I didn't write and that I didn't care about.
Your book is in part the story of a father who feels like he's totally blown it, and he's a father who isn't sure he ever really wanted to be a father, and he's grown increasingly alienated from his son. And I think, in a way, that story is going against the grain. This is a time when so many male writers have been writing about being the sensitive father, being the father that they felt they never had. And do you know what I mean?
I do. See, I'm sort of saved from that because I actually am a sensitive father, so I don't have to write about being one. and I don't have to write about the father I never had because I have a great father, you know, who's still a huge part of my life. So I understand fatherhood as in a way that you understand it when you've actually been given it. I've been given a chance to be a father to two interesting kids, and I've had a chance to have an interesting father. And these two experiences have been so shaping to my life that imagining their absence is very easy for me and very, very fertile for me, too.
I detect a certain cynicism about a lot of the sensitive father books that have been published in the past few years.
Yeah, well, it's not only the, I mean, I can't watch the Academy Awards anymore because I can't watch stand up see these guys who probably are home 15 hours a year holding up their Oscar and saying, you know, "This is for you, Jeremy." And,
Is it hard to write this kind of book, though, about alienation between father and son when you have children, out of fear that the children will think it's somehow about you and about them?
Yes, it is. More so when I'm going over the galleys. When I'm really composing the book, once I change a couple of... once the book takes on its own imaginative life, it's so clear to me that these aren't my children I'm talking about, and this really isn't me that I'm talking about, that I can't imagine anybody misconstruing it as autobiographical. But I think I need to feel that when I'm writing. When I see it in galleys, I say, gee, this is kind of cutting a little close to the reality here, but by that time it's too late.
Scott Spencer is my guest. His new novel is called Men in Black. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with novelist Scott Spencer. I've always admired your facility in writing about sex in fresh ways. And you find ways to write about both the passion and the absurdity of sex. Mm. Well, in Endless Love, you have a really passionate scene that goes on for tens of pages. And one of the things that's very unusual about the scene is that she's menstruating through it. In Preservation Hall, I think it is, there's a scene where there's crumpled tissues in the bedroom that imply that there was sex. I thought, what an interesting telling detail. I believe there was a diaphragm in one of your scenes, but I don't remember for sure.
Right.
But there's a short description that has more to do with the absurdity of sex that, in your new novel that, why don't I ask you to read it?
okay. They were down to the occasional poke, and even those were corrupted by their singularity. Sex, if it is not regular, becomes a little ludicrous. Your sexuality becomes a special guest star on some long-running sitcom. Your very sex organ becomes some old, safe, vaguely revered has-been, trotted out in a tux on Oscar night to receive his Lifetime Achievement Award.
How did you come up with that? Do you remember what you were thinking when you wrote that?
Of course not.
This is very, very funny. How do you approach writing about sex? And you've approached it from many different ways.
Well, I think that sex is interesting, and it shows something interesting about people, how they feel about it, how they feel during it, how they think about it, how they long for it, how they retreat from it. So to me, it remains a vital subject, really one of the very handfuls of profoundly serious things that a novelist can talk about. So I don't think that it's something that I would require of myself to make sure that there's enough sex in my book. But since there are usually people having relationships in my fiction, it seems just normal and logical and interesting to follow them into the bedroom. I mean, that's partly what fiction is. It's to open the doors that have been closed in our face, and that's certainly a door that's closed in people's faces normally.
Were you ever shy about following your characters into the bedroom?
No. No, not at all. I think that when I began to write about sex, I had the assurance of such incredible privacy since nobody read what I wrote. That it didn't seem that revealing at all.
Well, you know, it does interest me that you're able to write about, as I said before, both the passion of sex, the obsession of it, but also the absurdity it can have, too, that you see both sides.
Yes, well, it's a conversation between people, and it's, you know, to have it just be passionate and wonderful, although it can be that, doesn't seem real. I don't think that would remind people of anything that had ever happened to them.
Do you, when you write a new book, do you ever visit your book in bookstores and check on how it's doing?
I try not to, because I did just a few days ago. And I went into a store near my apartment, and they had a few copies there. And then I came back a couple days later, and there were more copies there. And I thought, are there returns already? Are they just ordering more? So I figured that unless I got into their computer, that this would not be a fruitful way for me to spend my time.
Because you'd always drive yourself crazy.
I just wouldn't be learning anything.
Oh.
I just wouldn't be learning anything. And while I was there, the book is in was on the table near the door, and I was standing there kind of looking at it, and then someone came and picked the book up. And the back jacket of this book has a picture of me. So I became frantic with shyness and found myself like some kind of deviant hiding behind the paperbacks, watching this man as he sort of read the flap copy and looked to thumb through the thing, tossed it back on the table, went and bought a cookbook, left. I better go home.
So he didn't spot you?
Not as far as I know.
You wrote a piece about Norman Mailer a few years ago when Harlot's Ghost came out.
Right.
And you said about him, you described him as a man whose passionate public life has so often seemed to make your own hermetic writer's life seem rather pallid. Have you ever wished to be a more Mailer-esque kind of writer in the sense that he's made his life into part of his art? He's lived this big life with big gestures and fist fights and running for office and, you know, having big debates at town hall and so on.
Well, I've made a list of the things that you've offered me. And I've checked yes to fistfights, no to debates in town hall, and no to running for office. Now, there is something very admirable and about the way Norman's lived his life. And sometimes my life, which is really very, very ordinary, may have to do with, you know, raising my kids and sitting at my table and writing my books, does seem kind of pallid in comparison. But I feel very lucky to be able to have the life I do, to have my kids and to have my profession and to have time to see my friends and play tennis and do a little traveling. So it's not really that I want to toss my life over, but there is, I don't think that anyone could fail to be impressed and a little wowed by all Norman's managed to do.
When you were young, what did you imagine the writer's life was like?
I imagine the writer's life was like sort of like the life that the writers lived in Reds, of walk-ups in Greenwich Village and martinis and love affairs and conversations that went on till 5 a.m. and grand gestures and feeling that the world was waiting eagerly for what you had to say next.
And that's not the writer's life you chose, though.
Well, that's not the writer's life that exists.
Oh, that's a good point.
Except again, an O'Hare airport. And if you're up at 5 a.m. because everyone's flight's been canceled.
That's not really the life you ended up wanting, though. That kind of sociable life, I think. You seem more...
No, it's not. It's not the life that I essentially led, because there were so many other things that I wanted too, and I also felt that, I'm not a person of endless capacities, and it would be hard for me to drink a bottle of Wild Turkey and stay up till 5 a.m. and expect to do anything the next day.
Scott Spencer, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you, Terry.
Scott Spencer's new novel is called Men in Black. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.